Greek. This is, of course, about the schizophrenic character. I think it's very important that at the outset of looking at madness in any form, that we look at the entire history of the idea of madness back as far as we can go. Else we will make the same errors that those who have gone before us have made. You know Montesquieu's famous old saying that those who ignore history are condemned to repeat it. I don't think that would be a very good idea for us. I won't go back to the Greeks since what the Greeks had to say about madness did not become available to Europeans until very late, what, 14th century or 13th century? I don't remember when the Greek writings were rediscovered. At any rate, I don't think that Greek thought had much to do with Northern European thought on the issue of madness. I will say that it was the Greeks who invented the idea that it was the juices, the fluids that brought about madness, some sort of imbalance of the fluids. This was either Galen's idea or Hippocrates' idea, and there's a little controversy about whether it was Galen or Hippocrates who mentioned this. I'll talk about the humoral theory of madness way on down the line. Right now, just suffice it to say that it's a very old idea. The the Europeans in the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th centuries apparently believed that madness was somehow owing to the invasion of bad fluids, bad spirits, bad juice, or the possession of it. And their solution to this problem of the invasion or possession of bad fluids was magic. That is to say, healing in those early centuries was done by the witch doctor or the shaman or the what's the other name for the witch doctor, shaman, medicine man. Now these, it fell to the lot of the whichever healer the tribe had, it fell to the lot of this person to do this thing called healing. That is to say, making people well of whatever unusual sorts of behavior they were engaging in. And incidentally, as far back as one wishes to go in the history of any group of human beings anywhere in the globe, anthropological evidences are that the group always had a healer, somebody that was trained from early youth in the lore of whatever healing was at the time, as an apprentice to the current healer, and in some cases raised from infancy as a healer. So the lore was passed on century after century after century by this process of the sorcerer always having an apprentice. And if the sorcerer or the medicine man, the shaman, or the witch doctor didn't have somebody that showed a little talent, the healer would find some other child that seemed to have natural inbuilt capabilities for acquiring this kind of lore. And I say this happened all over the world. Wherever there was a group of people, as far back as we have records, or reports of records, there was always that one person that was allotted the task of making people well. It should be obvious that madness is as old as humankind itself. As long as people have gotten together in groups, and of course, man is a social creature, like the other mammals, and always lives in groups. There's any other way. We are born of parents, and the parents stay with us, and there have always been clans or gatherings of people who are somehow related to each other. So man is a social creature. And as long as there have been people living together in groups, they have been relating to each other, and sometimes these relationships go awry, and somebody does something that is eccentric or odd or strange or unusual, and then that person is given over to the shaman to help, to change, to affect in some way. Later on, getting up into the teen centuries, maybe as early as 800, actually as early as 600 AD, the job of healing got divided up into those who had acquired the lore of using chemicals, herbs, plants, physical things, and those who were trained to be a pipeline to the gods. So that we had the shaman, what was at one time a person who ministered to every imaginable kind of disturbance, whether it was breaking the rules or getting physically ill or doing funny things, whatever. This one person would take care of all of this. Except taking people's property or attacking them. And that was, of course, taken care of by the warriors of the tribe. So the police came from a completely different source than the healers. But somewhere in the history of any tribe or any group, there came that split where person who was trained in invoking nature, invoking natural forces in behalf of his client, was split off from that person who was trained in invoking what were called the spirits, the gods. Now, for a long, long time, the person trained to invoke the natural forces, sorcerer, in other words, the medicine man, witch doctor, continued on in his practice. And I should point out that a shaman was really no slouch at healing. These people had a high cure rate for whatever kind of unusual behavior he was presented with. He or she was presented with. Some of the tribal shaman were shay women, I guess, who later on came to be called witches. The cure rate probably was in the realm of 3 out of 4 cases, for whatever. That's the cure rate today. So in the last, say, 20 centuries, we have not appreciably changed our cure rate, although seemingly or apparently we have become, quote, scientific about our cures and our understandings of what's the matter with people. Cure rate bumbles along at about the same rate. It doesn't seem to matter what is done, or it doesn't seem to matter what people believe is the matter and what they're doing about it. I find this at least interesting. Now, this is not to put down the present curate, it's to elevate the past curates and to elevate the curative powers, our conception of the curative powers of our forebears. They were damn good healers, yes.
Any?
Same thing we do, we have different words for it. Well, I am. You not may not be, but I'm talking about. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. One has to, however, we have excellent descriptions of the behaviors of people in tribal communities from all over the world, from way, way back. I refer you to The Golden Bough, which is 10 volumes of anthropological report by Sir James Frazer, The Golden Bough. And it's quite an experience to look back at what's been going on for so long and to see the similarity of the practices around the world, the similarity of the gods around the world, the similarity of the uses of natural substances, plants, poultices, molds, and that sort of thing around the world. Simply amazing how similar people's behaviors have been around the world throughout recorded history. So it's true that we can hardly go back and watch these people, but there's a large mass of data, of information, of reports done by anthropologists on what's been going on for so long. And I should have prefaced what I'm saying with this not warning, this counsel. As long as you make yourself talk about behavior, which is to say what people do, and not talk about, except parenthetically, what's going on inside, then there will be very little problem of communication and mutual understanding. It's when people start talking about things that cannot be seen, for instance, desires, motives, feelings, thoughts, egos, ids, and that sort of thing. When we talk to each other about these fictions, then we stop understanding each other because we have no way of knowing what the other guy is talking about, or have very little assurance that we're using the same words in the same way. I will speak to you at length, perhaps ad nauseum, on the problem of words in the domain of madness. I'll take a whole period for it. It is absolutely necessary because the domain of madness is a complete mess, owing to the practices mainly of 19th century healers of speaking in Greek instead of in Germanic. When somebody lies down and says, oh, my Zurch aches. Maybe he says Zurch, we say belly. And the healer is summoned and told that this guy said that his Zurch ached. What is he going to do about it? I submit that that's pretty understandable kind of communication, and that I can imagine a person born in the first century AD would do it pretty much the same as a person born in the 20th century AD. Okay? When people want to communicate, they communicate what we now say called behaviorally. They talk about what people do. Now, where was I? I had the... I'm trying to do two things at once. I want to trace the history of madness and the history of healing thereof, down to the present, and I want to show the correspondence between what people thought was the matter with people who did funny things and what they did about it. Because the claim is that these were always correlated. What you think is the matter with somebody determines what you are going to do to, for, or with that somebody. So that Healing and madness are heads and tails of the same coin. Always have been, always will be. Your efficiency as a healer is going to be circumscribed drastically by what you believe is the matter with people who do funny things. That is to say, who do mad things. So it behooves you, if you want to be an efficient healer, to have a very clear, coherent, consistent, and a very comprehensive view of madness. Because remember, that's going to be the frame of reference out of which you are going to take out your healing procedures and use them. So, first we have this idea that bad juice was what got odd behavior or unusual behavior. And the way to get rid of the bad juice, or dilute it, or whatever you can do to juice, fluid, spirit, same thing, is to have a repertoire of magical behaviors, which you now do. You uncork your magic, and you do your passes and your incantations, and maybe you throw some mud, if there's a swelling somewhere, you throw some mud on it from a certain place. By the way, I would advise you, if you're not going to read Sir James Frazer, The Golden Bough, all 10 volumes, at least read the first volume. That's on magic and religion. There's a novel out now called The Clan of the Cave Bear. It's a novel, pure fantasy, but this author spent a lot of time reading up on the anthropology of the shaman. And you can get a lot of information about shaman by reading this book. And it's like coating a bitter pill. It goes down very easily. Now, when the gods came to Europe, the difference between a spirit, and here I must speak Latin, I could say that the difference between a ghost, which is to speak Germanic, same idea. The difference between a ghost or spirit and a god is that the latter got anthropomorphized, or at least animalized. That is to say, the Europeans started talking to each other about a living entity that could transcend natural laws. Most of these living entities turned out to be humanoid, that is to say, anthropomorphic, having human form. Now, when that happened, when the spirits that were all in throughout nature, it was called pantheism, we call it in retrospect pantheism. God is everywhere, the gods are everywhere, the spirits are everywhere, in the plants and the animals, in the rocks and the springs, in the sky and the sea and the sun and the wind and so on. These were all spirits. When those became godified or theodized or deified, The tribe had to split the function from split the healing function into a healing and a ministerial function. Now, the tribe needed an intermediary to these entity type gods, as over against the gods in throughout nature. So we had the advent of the priest. And after whoever knows how many decades or centuries, after the advent of the priest, it fell to his lot. Notice that we have a bit of chauvinism entering the picture now, to be an intermediary between his clients, who were in some kind of trouble, and the gods that he was the mouthpiece for. So he got the job of being the intermediary. And the witch doctor, shaman, more and more went to doing the work of healing the bodily discomforts. And the priest now took up the job of dealing with odd and eccentric behaviors. When somebody started acting goofy, whereas before they had the priest, they'd send the goofy guy to the shaman. But once the priest came into the picture, they would send the goofy guy to the priest. And he was supposed to do something about the evil spirit that had somehow possessed, taken over this person, or gotten into this person. So we still had a bad spirit here. But now this was the bad spirit was a personified or anthropomorphized spirit instead of a natural force. Now, since the belief was that the source of this strange behavior, this disapproved behavior, saying crazy things, or having convulsions, or staring off into the sky, or staring at the sun, or any number of a jillion things that we will come to know as symptoms. The job then of the priest was to exorcise, that is to say, get the evil spirit out of the person. And the priesthood developed a lot of methods of passes and whatnot. That is, by the way, the passes and incantations and rather the rituals and whatnot that were developed down through the Dark Ages are indistinguishable from magic. As if somebody from Mars were to look at the magician and the priest, he wouldn't be able to tell the difference in as far as their behavior patterns were concerned. They were both passes and chants and making strange gestures. Making strange noises and making strange gestures seem to be the major sources of repertoire as far as healing now of what we will start calling mental illnesses. About 1200, I think, I'm not really sure of this, The priestly group, and of course each tribe had its own name for this person, as over against the medicine person, the herbal person, I should say, the physician, although they didn't call this person the physician and the priest, but later on this was going, guy is going to be called the physician, and the other one is going to be called the priest. I don't know, it depends on the dialect you're talking. Anyway, around 1200, the priest began to try to get the evil spirit or evil soul, alien soul, which clearly was a bad one, because this person was doing disapproved things. If this person were doing approved things, then that person was seen as harboring good spirits or good deities, and was elevated and looked up to as, quote, inspired. That is, this fluid had flowed into the person and it was good. And so there was no reason now to cure the person. The person had no ill spirit in him or her, so there wasn't anything to do other than perhaps elevate this person, give them robes and whatnot, and sanctify them. But if the person were doing things that were disapproved, then there was very good reason to get the evil spirit out. Gradually, the practice developed of squeezing the evil spirits out, or beating the evil spirits out. Now, there's only one way you can squeeze or beat an evil spirit out of a body. You've got to beat or squeeze the body. And so torture came to be a very, very, let's say, the priest developed a large repertoire of ways of getting, occasioning great extreme pain in order to get that, to exorcise that evil spirit from the body. By 1400, as you know, the Inquisition reared its ugly head. And now the exorcists were enrolled for the function of getting the evil spirits out of those people who were diagnosed as witches, mostly women. And by 1500, the practice had gotten to where they would simply kill the person who was caught doing disapproved things. And the priesthood was zealous about catching witches, people who practiced witchcraft. They were all women. The sorcerers were left alone, and because apparently they were not in competition with the priests for clientele. But whenever they would catch a witch, they would simply kill her after extreme torture. And you know, they put them on the rack and literally rack it on them and cut them up all over and then burn them. And sure enough, the evil spirit would go away. Now, this was done in good faith, apparently, and with the firm belief that this is the way to liberate the person from the clenches of this evil spirit that has taken over, to liberate the soul from this evil soul. And the only way they saw they could do it was destroy the container that housed these two souls, So both of them got liberated. But it was very clear that you cure all your patients that way. If your notion of cure is the getting rid of this bad spirit. Thought just flashed in my head, whimsical and capricious, no doubt, but I think of Ida Rolf, the very modern therapeutic method of literally kneading, putting your knuckles out like that and grinding into that muscle to get the retroflected evil or whatever bad stuff is in it, which is a very extremely modern therapeutic procedure practiced by scores and scores of people. I have no idea how many people are still practicing Rolfing today, but it must have numbered into the thousands, and for a while there, into tens of thousands. Anybody here ever undergo Rolfing? Well, again, a Martian looking at the priest before he started killing his patients, when he was still trying to squeeze the bad fluid out, would be hard put to distinguish the behavior of Ida Rolf and this priest, would he not? And the ideology of the Reichian wing of modern psychopathology. I'm talking about Wilhelm Reich, who invented all of the body therapies. The body therapies come from Wilhelm Reich, his Orgone. Even the ideology is indistinguishable. It's the spirit theory of madness. The spirit theory of madness hasn't gone away. It has not gone away at all. It is very, very much in evidence in 1982. Very, very widespread belief. The latest version of it is inherent in some research that's being done right now in many, many places in the United States, where the physicians are ostensibly studying the process they call neurohumoral transmission. The idea is that there's some juice twixt the synapses, the dendrite and synapse, which do not touch, as you know. There's a juice that transfers the electrical impulse from the axon fibrils to the dendrite fibrils across a gap. And the only way it gets there is by some sort of fluid medium. And now you can read countless articles where these people say, aha, we have finally found the seat of schizophrenia. It's a humoral transmitter imbalance. Which always strikes me as a rather interesting idea. Imbalance, that means there's more of one of these juices than another juice. And if balance is the way you get the person to act normal, then you would put a pipette into that gap and suck out some of that juice so that the two now are in balance, I gather. Maybe they see these in little cups and not mixed, so that you could put your pipette into one cup and suck out, you know, just siphon it out, then you've got a balance of the juices, the spirits, and you've got yourself a sane nut. Forgive me if I'm a little sarcastic about the continuance of the juice theory of madness. I would have thought that it would have died out at the turn of the 20th century, but it did not, and it's getting more and more in vogue as we near the 21st century, the onset of the 21st century. Now, where was I before I went off onto that tirade about neurohumoral transmitters? Oh yes, I was at the Inquisition, where the witches got killed off by the hundreds, I guess by the thousands. The population of witches practically disappeared by 1600, because they got killed so regularly and so quickly. Interesting sidelight regarding madness and the symptoms thereof. The priests had ways of proving that some woman that had been doing her thing, or maybe didn't pay her bills or something, was a witch. They would, and I suspect that this was the source of the later tortures that were used. They would get a sharp object, and they would probe every square quarter inch of the entire body, and enough to get the woman to yelp. Then, when they got to a spot where she didn't yelp, they would say, "Well, huh? There's the witch's claw. We have found our witch." Because she has an anesthetic region somewhere on her skin. Anesthesia is one of the major tactics of the hysterics, as we will see later on, and frequently an hysteric will be anesthetic over maybe half of the skin. And by definition, not know it, and not know that she's anesthetic, because anesthesia is a way of not knowing, is it not? Anesthesia is not feeling something. Well, for whatever reason that a person anesthetizes something of one's body, back to our sleuth priests, they could spot a witch very easily by the simple procedure of poking them. And as soon as they found any spot that was anesthetic, they'd say, proof positive, burn the witch. And they did. And thousands and thousands of these poor NFs got fried. Yeah. I don't either. My guess is that the sorcerers, see, the males were sorcerers. They weren't witches. They called them sorcerers. Seemed more interested in getting control over natural forces, and really would not bother trying to treat people. People wouldn't come to them for help. They were what? No, actually, I think that Frazier says this, that the sorcerer was they were the first alchemist, they were the first scientists. So the sorcerer turned into scientists later on, a few centuries later. So they really were trying to get power over nature. They weren't really terribly interested in healing, but the women were, and people would.